Okay, so this is a karyotype, and you obtain a karyotype by getting a cell at a certain point in the cell cycle. So these are replicated chromosomes. As you can see, each one has two sister chromatids, and they narrow significantly at the centromere. So the centromere looks basically like we've just put a belt around the two chromatids, and we've really cinched it in tightly. And you have to catch them after they're replicated and in prophase, where they start to condense. And so otherwise they'd be too long and stringy. When you catch them at the right point, it's surprising how consistent that condensation is. So you take something that was really long and stretched out, and now you condense it. And if you look, there's very little difference in the apparent length of the homologous pairs. So there's very little variation in how the chromosomes condense prior to cell division. But back in the old days when we used to do this, when I took genetics class, what you would get is a black and white photograph of a cell, and or of a nucleus of a cell, and then much like kindergarten, they would give us a pair of scissors. And I remember I was a sophomore in college, and they gave us the scissors with the little rounded ends. I mean, when you about the time that you start feeling like you're really a grown-up, there's the man slapping you back down again, giving you rounded-off scissors. And we would have to cut out the chromosomes, and then we had a standard template that we had for human karyotypes. That would be chromosome 1A, 1B, and then we would take these little chromosomes and try to match them up by size. Also, you can stain the nucleus of the cell with different stains that stain specific types of DNA or DNA protein complexes. And so you get, they're referred to as banding or staining patterns. So if you have a couple chromosomes that are similar in size and shape, like these two would be 4 and 5 and 6, are without staining are kind of tough. But when you see that you get the staining, that it's fairly easy to match up the patterns present on the chromosome. And so now it's just all done on the computer. You click this one, pairs up with that one, and then it lines them up, and then the computer software actually figures out which ones on average are larger than the others. And in human chromosomes are numbered from largest to smallest, and then you get the sex chromosomes, X and Y. X is actually about ninth in size, eighth or ninth in size. excuse me. But some of the properties that we can look at in addition to size and the staining or banding patterns is the relative position of where the centromere is. It's called a centromere, but it's not always in the center. Okay? So one is an example of one where it's pretty close to the center. So being scientists, we have to come up with terminology for these things. Okay? And this is true in replicated or unreplicated chromosomes. So in the karyotype, we've got the replicated ones, but if I'm just drawing on a board, when I draw a single chromatid or chromosome, if I draw the centromere, it's just a circle on there. Okay? We still can determine the relative or refer to the relative position of the centromere, even in a non-replicated chromosome. So the first one's metacentric, and that means it's right about the middle. Meta means middle or center. So it seems kind of redundant to have the phrases centric and meta combined. But we're talking now centromere. Centric is short for centromere. It's not short. Another way of saying center. So the centromere in the middle. Submetacentric. Okay. Submetacentric, it is between the middle and one end, but it's not very far out there. So if you want to think about submetacentric being kind of halfway between the centromere and the end, it's anything that you can see where it's not in the center, but it's also not getting close to the end. Then we've got acrocentric. And acrocentric is near the end, but not at the end. So there's a little bit out there. That would make it acrocentric. And then something that's telocentric, the centromere is actually at the end of a chromosome. So when you do a karyotype, that's one of the things that you look for is the relative position. So humans really don't have any that are strictly telocentric. 22 is awfully close, and if you get a couple of human geneticists in a bar fight or in a bar, get them sloppy drunk, you maybe can induce a slap fight between them about whether 22 is acrocentric or telocentric. But, you know, it's close. You're not going to see any points in your world about whether 22 is acrocentric or telocentric. But, for example, 13, 14, that they're acrocentric, that the vast majority of the chromosome is on one side of the centromere. One's an example of a metacentric. 4 is a submetacentric. Actually, quite a few of them are submetacentrics. 9, 10, 12 are submetacentrics. So just take a look at, this slide's available online for you. It's from the book. Just take a look at them. Make sure that you're comfortable with what that terminology is. But the relative position of a centromere is important when we start talking about some of these rearrangements that take place. So if they happen one end of a chromosome or another, or one end of a centromere or the other, they play out entirely differently than if they actually involve the centromere in them. And when we get a chromosome where they're not evenly distributed, so like 4, for example, 4 is a submetacentric. We refer to either the short arm or long arm of a chromosome, or P and Q. P is typically the short, Q is typically the long. So if you look at a framework map or the relative position of a locus, it will give an address like 4P and then give some other numbers. What that typically is, chromosome 4, P the short arm, and those numbers refer to individual bands that are seen on staining. So physically you can lock down the location of where a gene is on the chromosome. And 4 and 5 in humans, we'll talk about deletions later, but 4 and 5 are especially prone to losing parts of these short arms. In some cases, the entire short arm is lost of the chromosome. All right. So we'll talk about some chromosomal variations. Some of them are true mutations because we're making fairly dramatic changes in the genetic content. And you can change genetic content not just in the sequences, but also changing their relative location matters. That if we take a gene that's typically expressed at a certain level at its normal location, excuse me, and we move it to a new location in the genome, those sort of the environmental effects, not from the outside the individual, but the environment of where it is on a chromosome, the surrounding sequences, can affect the way in which that's expressed. And so you get a different outcome. So that, in a strict sense, could be deemed a mutation as well. And then, so we'll talk about bits of DNA moving and around. And then we'll also talk about what happens when you get changes in the number of individual chromosomes or changes in the number of entire sets of chromosomes. Okay, so, and this is just a visual representation of what I just told you. With chromosomal rearrangements, we'll be looking at either translocations, insertions, deletions are the most common. Aneuploidy, that's when we're changing the number of a single chromosome. And polyploidy is when we change the number of entire sets. So typically, your somatic cells are 2N. When we would talk about polyploidy, we would be talking about cells that are either 1N or 3N. Okay, but we'll go into more detail on those. All right, so here's an example of a duplication event that takes place. And in duplication, a region of one chromosome, right, so it's these would be homologs that line up. And most of these events take place during, in some cases, cell division. Excuse me. But really the ones that matter to us the most are the ones that take place during meiosis, when tetrad formation takes place. But some of them can take place during replication, that we get odd structures that take place, and the DNA polymerase does some odd things. So here's an example of a duplication. We've got two homologs. Here's the normal sequence of genes. The little dot represents the centromere. And if we look here, we've got loci ENF, or genes ENF. They should be present a single copy. And down here, the entire region with ENF has been duplicated on this homolog. So normally you'd expect one copy, but on this homolog, we now have two copies of that gene. Okay. And duplication events happen on a fairly regular basis. That there's this, it's not an urban legend even, but there's this misconception that's out there that it's impossible to increase the amount of genetic material in an organism. People that argue against evolution through natural selection say it's impossible to start out with bacteria and wind up with a really complicated genome of something like rice. Rice has quite a bit more DNA in the cells than you have. That where does the extra genetic material come from? Well, we talked about horizontal transfer the other day or last week, how bacteria can acquire new DNA from outside sources, and duplication events take place where regions of a chromosome can be duplicated. You then have more DNA. And duplication events are important in evolution. And the reason for that is it allows mutation without being a lethal condition. Okay? So if we had this situation, and we'll say that gene F is involved in carbohydrate utilization. We'll say then that this organism could use glucose really well, couldn't use galactose very well as a carbon source. Okay? So it's got this F gene, which is involved in utilizing glucose and extracting energy from glucose. It undergoes a duplication event. And so now we've got a chromosome, so we've got two copies of that gene. Right? Now, it may not be great in the immediate sense that now we've got two copies. The cell has to balance out the fact that now there are three total copies of that gene as opposed to two. And we talked about the fact with bar bodies that cells like having regular numbers of genes. That when you start altering the numbers of genes in a cell, it gets tougher for the cell to regulate those genes when they're expressed. So there may be a little bit of overexpression early on, but with that presence of F, the extra copy of F, what it allows to happen is if this chromosome just had a single copy of F, if there is a random mutation that takes place just as a result of UV light or a chemical insult or just a hiccup during replication where the polymerase makes a mistake that's not caught, if you lose the function of this F, if there's only a single copy of it, and glucose is your main food source, now you've got a mutation, you're not going to make a protein that's got the same level of function, it puts the life of this organism at jeopardy. And so it's very unlikely that you would see much mutation, much variation from the fully functional copy of this gene. But if you get a duplication event where now you've got an extra copy on the chromosome, if one of those copies of the gene gets a mutation in it, as long as the other one is still wild type, it's not been altered, you still have 100% enzyme activity. You can still utilize glucose all you want. And so what happens over time is when you get a duplication event, they've done these studies in organisms that have relatively short generation times. Yeast, the best study was done in yeast, where they took a chromosome, introduced a duplication event at a couple of spots, and they did this several different types of genes at multiple locations in chromosomes just to make sure it wasn't this gene at this location. It's true. They did it for over 20 genes and moved them even to locations where they don't normally occur. So if you have a duplication event and you get a mutation in one of them, it's okay. This one's still functional. The cell still lives. It's not going to be selected against. Okay, so this one goes on. And then later, what they found at the end of the study is they would find multiple mutations in one copy of the gene and no mutations of any significance in the other copy. But when they set these up, they tracked multiple lines of cells. And so what they would find is there was variation in which of the genes was mutated and which of the genes wasn't. But the thing is that one of them would accumulate mutations, the other wouldn't. And the reason for that is, and it's something that I will tend to stress throughout the semester, is people tend to simplify evolution through natural selection as a random process. It's not. The mutation part of it is random, but selection, by definition, is anything but random. If you select something, you're just not randomly going in there and grabbing. You're selecting based on traits. So if you get a scenario where you've already picked up a couple of mutations in this gene, it's starting to alter, and now you pick up a mutation in this gene, okay, you no longer have a fully functional version of that gene around. So you don't have the normal activity, enzymatic activity that you would have, and so this is selected against. Okay? And so as a result, when you get a duplication, one of the partners of the duplication event is freed up to be altered, and sometimes those mutations in something like a gene that encodes an enzyme that could utilize glucose, you get a few mutations and you wind up with a gene that then could utilize galactose. And it's something that is fairly common if you study genomics or biochemistry, is the genes encoding enzymes that carry out very similar functions tend to have fairly high DNA identity levels, that if we line up their sequences, that they match up base for base in a lot of the regions, and then the actual active sites that will interact with the two different substrates, that's where we see the differences. And the mutations, again, are random, but the selection. If you get to a point where you can utilize glucose and you can utilize galactose inefficiently, that's going to give you an advantage over ones that could just utilize glucose. And then you get a population that could do that. It accumulates a few more mutations, and all of a sudden it could utilize galactose more efficiently. So it's not this matter where a yeast cell wakes up in the morning and all of a sudden it can utilize both glucose and galactose. It's an organism accumulates small mutations throughout its life, its offspring, they're passed along to its offspring, and if those offspring are slightly more successful in the environment, their offspring will be present at a greater frequency of the population. And you give it a couple billion years to do that, and it's not only quite possible, it's very likely that that takes place. So duplication is an essential event, but we're going to focus on it for most of the rest of the day being something that messes up the genetics of an organism. But in terms of evolution, it's an essential event in evolutionary biology. Okay, so if you get a duplicated chromosome, one of the problems that happens, remember we talked about during meiosis when you get tetrad formation, the homologs pair up, that they tend to pair up based on the ends of the chromosomes. And that happens so much so that even the X and Y chromosome have specialized ends that allow them to match up even though there's dramatic difference in size. So now we've got a chromosome here with a duplication. Okay, of E and F. Here we've got our normal chromosome, and their ends are pretty far away. So how do they pair up? And actually, it's this looping mechanism that takes place that sort of forces the telomeres of the chromosome to pair up. So if you happen to catch a picture of a cell nucleus during tetrad formation, and one of the chromosomes is duplicated, you see this thickening of a chromosome in the duplicated region. And it's because of this looping out event that E and F, they don't have anything else to pair up with. This E, this F are paired up. G's paired up here, and the telomeres are paired up. But you get this less than ideal pairing. So one of the things that happens is it's less likely that there'll be recombination between this F and G because this chromosome is looping out a way to try and squeeze down to the same length. Okay. And so here's an example from where you can get multiple duplications. We're looking at a fly eye. Here, this is a normal type female fly. So it's a red color, relatively large. And then you get a duplication of the BAR gene. It's referred to as the BAR gene. Again, in Drosophila genetics, the name of the gene typically describes some aspect of the mutant phenotype. Not what it normally does, but what happens when things go wrong with that gene. So this is referred to as the BAR because if you get a severe mutation in this gene, the eyes, instead of being big and round, become small and drawn out, narrow and drawn out, so they look like a bar instead of a beach ball. And so if you get one duplication event on one chromosome, the eyes become narrower. They start to look, it looks kind of like a kidney bean. If you get two copies on two chromosomes, they're even narrower. And then this is that effect that I was talking about, how what surrounds you on the chromosome matters. Okay, these two both have four copies of the BAR gene, but in this case, you've got three copies on one chromosome, one copy on the other, and this phenotype is much more severe than this one. And so it's just not the copy of the genes, it's also the location of the genes that matters. Okay. Let's see. And this is talking about the... let's see if we get a better picture. Nope. Okay, the gene dosage effect of a duplication and how that plays out. And so here we've got three genes, A, B, and C. Remember, the vast majority of genes that we'll talk about in here will result in the expression of a protein. And so then we've got proteins A, B, and C that are produced in roughly equal amounts, especially in development. When an organism is developing from a fertilized egg to a fully formed organism, the regulation of those genes is exquisitely sensitive. Okay. For the most part, once you're formed and you go about, you know, functioning as a human outside of your mother's womb, it's really unusual that all of a sudden something happens with gene expression and you get this really dramatic change in phenotype. That there are some late developing genetic disorders like Huntington's, which is a neurological disease. But for the most part, if you're born, a lot of the big events in your life have already taken place, and it's highly unlikely that you're just going to wake up one day and you don't have an arm. But, I mean, if you like Kafka, read that explanation into it, that he actually just had this horizontal transfer of an event and became a big cockroach overnight. It makes it a lot less soul-searching of a story if you just turn it into a science fiction story instead. Just don't do that. Write the paper, get an F on it, and then come back and blame me. I'm just saying in your free time, not in a classroom, write up that version of it. But this is showing during development. When we're going from an embryo, this is a really common genetic model organism called the zebrafish. You can buy them for about $1.25 at Petco. But Dave Rubin in the School of Biological Sciences uses zebrafish. They're easy to track what genes are expressed at which point during development. And when David buys them, he can't buy them from the pet store since they're being used for research and they've got a backbone. He's got to buy them from scientific research companies, and so they cost a lot more than $1.25 for David. But under normal development, A, B, and C are roughly equal concentrations during the developmental stage, and so you get this normal stripe pattern, which is why the fish gets its name a zebrafish. But if you get a duplication event, in this case a B, now we've got two functional copies of B. We're going to make twice as much protein, so that ratio of A, B, and C has now been altered. And in development, the timing and magnitude of gene expression is essential. Right? Gene expression during development is, it's like a symphony. Right? It's the timing and it's how much expression you get or how little expression you get at times that makes all the difference. And mentioned before, about half of all fertilized eggs never make it, that they're spontaneously aborted by the mother's body because stuff goes wrong with the fetus during development, that either the timing or the magnitude of expression isn't right and the fetus doesn't develop properly. This is what happened to Honey Boo Boo's niece. Those of you watching, it's got two thumbs on one hand. If ever you could have called a family that something like that would happen to, it's whatever their last name, the Honey Boo Boo family. Okay, so this balance is out of whack now because we've got too much B. And instead of stripes, this is a fairly benign developmental change that the zebrafish gets spots. But if you start getting duplications, it becomes very likely that you get fairly dramatic changes. The more complicated the organism, the more severe the changes tend to be. That there's one locus in humans that if you get a duplication event from that, that the spinal column develops on the outside instead of the inside of the torso. And so just the balance, I can't stress enough how delicate that balance is between timing and levels of expression, and duplication and deletions throw that out of whack. Okay, now we're going to talk about deletions. You guys have worked in Microsoft Word enough to understand what delete means. We're just going to remove part of a chromosome. And so now we've gone from one that's got the same genes we talked about before. Now instead of duplicating ENF, we'll delete ENF. So now we're missing copies of genes on that chromosome. Okay. And when these things pair up, something very similar happens, but for a completely different reason. When tetrad formation takes place, there's nothing homologous to E and F on its homolog. And so there's nothing to line up, plus it's longer, so we want the telomeres to line up. E and F aren't homologous to anything, so E and F will be looped out. Okay? And it's a combination of those two things. The chromosomes want the ends to pair up, and so this one's longer than this one, so something's got to loop out. But if just anything loops out, that's not optimal. Okay? This isn't an ideal situation. The cell's trying to make the best of a less than ideal situation. So the best thing that can happen is the parts that the specific sequences don't line up. There's no homolog to that. Let's loop those out. And so C lines up, D lines up, G lines up, and so E and F are the ones that loop out. I just don't want you to think it's just any old part loops out to shorten the one chromosome. It's not. It's the parts that don't share homologous sequences with its partner. Okay, and as you can imagine, losing copies of of genes is significant change in terms of cells. That now you don't have the redundancy, so the gene copy number is cut in half. Plus, remember, with more complicated organisms, the individual matters. So now you only have one copy of a gene. If you get a mutation in that gene, those cells are non-functional from that point on. Yep. So they're basically the same, except it's... So in this one, it's the one with the duplication that will do the looping, because it's got the extra copies of E and F here that will loop out. And in this one, it's the same thing. It's trying to line up the ends of the chromosome, the telomeres, and trying to line up all of these homologous sequences. But in this case, it's the one without the deletion. It's always the longer one that loops. So in a duplication, the one that's been duplicated loops. In a deletion event, the one without the deletion event loops out. Okay, then we've got inversion. And inversion is just a flipping of sequences. And typically when we refer to inversion, that we're keeping it at the same location on the chromosome. It's not a movement. It's just we're taking something, flipping it 180 degrees, and putting it back in its original spot. So here we're going to have an inversion of the part of the chromosome that's got D, E, and F. Okay. And so it's still, after the inversion, it still has basically the same genetic content. Okay. But that idea that we've talked about a few times is what surrounds you matters. So now, D's not immediately downstream of C. D's downstream of G. Okay, or G is adjacent to D is adjacent to G, and now F is closer to C. D and F, it wouldn't be surprising if D and F are expressed at different levels in this scenario. E will probably be expressed at about the same levels because E is still surrounded by D and F. Everything around it is still in the same orientation. So we refer to E as being an insulated locus, that it's part of an inversion, but it's not near the ends. And so the effects on E are less severe than the effects of expression on F and D are in an inversion. Okay. And so there are two types of inversions. You can have a paracentric or a pericentric. Okay. Oh, okay. Hang on. This is just showing how crossing over takes place. Okay, so with the one, don't panic. Okay, I'll tell you that first. Okay, when we've been talking about lining up of chromosomes, okay, with deletions and duplications, it's just been something's got it, something doesn't. Now we've got a whole other set of problems. Both of these chromosomes have those sequences, but now one of them's got it flipped 180 degrees compared to the other, and the cell really still wants those things to line up. And so what it does is it forms really bizarre structures to try and mimic that lining up. And so it tends to make things that look like highway exits in major cities. Okay? Don't try to learn this until you get to Larson in 350. And Larson's all about bizarre DNA structures. And so he'll pull out 8 different colors of markers and draw this thing and start erasing and show you how they cross over and what happens. But you get these intermediate structures where for a while the chromosomes are sort of connected. The homologs are connected. And then you get little bits that occasionally get left out. Okay, but if the inversion event is on one side of the chromosome, one side of the centromere, then that's the pericentric. Okay? If it's pericentric, peri means like in perimeter, to surround. So pericentric means it surrounds the centromere. That the inversion event itself actually moved the relative position of the centromere. Okay, and pericentric ones are much more severe mutations. So here's an example of a pericentric. Since the centromere was inside of the region here that was inverted, that the centromere changes position. Yep. Pericentric, the inversion, the entire inversion takes place on one side or other of the centromere. Okay. Peri, the centromere is within the region that's inverted. And so the centromere itself lines up. Trying to get the centromeres to line up during, or the centromeres moved, when you line up chromosomes, you try to get a situation in which the centromeres line up. This thing is much tougher to resolve. And so you tend to get non-viable gametes that result. If you've got this in your cells and you try to carry out meiosis, that you'll wind up with severe deletions as a result of them trying to the cells trying to resolve a pericentric inversion. So I want you to understand what an inversion is, that you don't have a gene dosage effect, but you do have a gene localization effect of expression. The definitions of pericentric, pericentric, and that pericentrics are much tougher for the cell to resolve. Okay. Okay, so, and one of the differences between humans and chimps in genetics, that they're actually, when we look at chromosomes of humans and chimps, there are very few major rearrangements of chromosomes. So, again, if I occasionally, as part of my job, get to interact with people that just flat out do not like the idea of human ascent through evolution, and so one of the things that I point out is how similar we are with chimps and both chromosome structure and also the DNA sequences. And I ultimately just leave it with, okay, if you need to bring in a deity to the story, do you really feel better about yourself knowing that if you were created, you were created as Chimp Mach 2 is the name of the blueprint that you were created from, because the human genome and the chimp genome are surprisingly similar. And one of the differences between humans and chimps is chromosome 4. Remember, in humans, chromosome 4 is a submetacentric chromosome. And in chimps, it's still submetacentric, but the centromere is much more closer to being a metacentric chromosome. And when we go in and look at the genes in those regions of the human and the chimp chromosomes, we see high identity among these sequences to the point that we can identify someplace along the lines there was an inversion event, and more than likely it was in the human because some closer relatives to chimps have centromere location that's more consistent with that. So someplace in human evolution we've had a relatively large inversion event that was a pericentric one that moved the position of the centromere on chromosome 4. And we lived through it. So congratulations on that. I'd be very lonely in here if we didn't. Okay, then the next thing we'll talk about are translocations. Translocations are movement. Okay? We're going to pull out a fragment of DNA from one chromosome and we're going to move it. And we can move DNA. Typically when we do that, we move DNA back. And so we can have, if we move the same sequences and the same amount of DNA back, it's referred to as a reciprocal translocation. The same bits are moving two different directions. If we're not getting the same stuff back, it's a non-reciprocal translocation. So one chromosome is having three genes moved over to its homolog, but only one of those three is coming back. And then You get something referred to as a Robertsonian translocation, in which we're doing things in such a way that it causes two chromosomes to basically fuse together. Okay, so here's an example of a translocation where, in this case, we've got two different chromosomes. And what will happen is we've got E and F moving from this chromosome onto a non-homolog. And so now, instead of E and F being on this one, it's going to move down here. But we're going to move Q and R the opposite direction. We're going to keep the two chromosomes will be roughly equal size at the end of this. So we're basically exchanging E and F with Q and R. And so we've changed the chromosome on which these genes is located. Okay. So that would be, that's an example of a reciprocal translocation, that something moved each direction. E and F went from one chromosome to the other, Q and R went the other direction. Non-reciprocal would be if we moved D, E, and F to this one, and we only got Q sent back. Okay. At that point, this chromosome would have D, E, and F, in addition to there would be a Q here as well. So this chromosome would be longer than this one. It got three genes moved over. It only moved one across. It's two genes larger now. Yep.
This is reciprocal?
This is considered reciprocal.
Non-reciprocal,
the same amount of information is not moved back. So it could either be all or nothing. It could be, 3 to 1 if the amount of information being moved back and forth is not the same. Okay. All right, so with a Robertsonian, what happens is you get translocations that take place near the centromeres. And this typically takes place in humans and acrocentric chromosomes. In other organisms, it can take place with acrocentric or telocentric. But you get breakpoints that take place very near the centromere. Okay. And so what happens is, if you get a translocation, if you just try moving this bit over to this chromosome, you don't have a centromere here. If this part just tries attaching over here, so you get a break that happens on each one on different sides of the centromere. Okay, so here we've got it on the short arm. Here we've got it on the long arm, but both are very close to the centromere. So what tends to happen is, in a Robertsonian translocation, this end of the short arm and this short arm plus the centromere can recombine. And now you've got a chromosome that can be replicated. It's got a centromere. It's got a little bit of this chromosome, a little bit of that. It's really small. And then these two large chromosomes do the same thing. This one contains a centromere. This one won't after the break. So this big region of the gray one recombines with this long arm of the red one, and they make a very long metacentric chromosome. Okay. Now, what typically happens is there's very little genetic information contained in this, I forget what the technical term is, but we'll just call it a nubbin in here. It's a little miniature one. There tends to be very little important information out at the ends of most chromosomes. The X chromosome is one of the exceptions to that rule in humans. And so many times what happens is this will be maintained as essentially a copy of this chromosome and this chromosome together. And nubbin here is lost because it's not needed. And these things tend not to line up really well during cell division. Okay, so what happens in a Robertsonian translocation is essentially two chromosomes fused together at the centromere. But they will be there'll be chromosomes which you don't have much information on one side of the centromere. And where that PlaysApp. No, don't need to resolve that one. Here are some Robertsonian events that we see again in human chromosomes, this time chromosome 2. Human chromosome 2 looks a lot like two chromosomes combined from other apes. And if we look at it with chimps, that we can kind of make sense of it from a Robertsonian translocation. Gorillas look very similar to chimps. Orangutans are a little bit further away. And orangutans are, so it would technically be considered a telocentric chromosome. And so with a Robertsonian translocation, we could take these three organisms and make sense out of a relatively large human 2 chromosome. So you've not only had an inversion event, you've had a Robertsonian translocation. We should have time to get into it, that there are some cases of Down syndrome that are caused by Robertsonian translocations, where you get an extra copy of chromosome, either 21 or in some cases 14, that get carried along because they're part of a Robertsonian event. And so there are some cases of, it's referred to as familial Down syndrome, where certain families have Down syndrome more common than others. It's because of a Robertsonian translocation event that gives offspring basically a 50-50 chance of having an extra chromosome in there. Okay, so aneuploidy. Those are the big rearrangement events, deletions, duplications, inversions, translocations. Now we're going to talk about what happens when you get an extra chromosome or you're missing a chromosome. So typically a deletion event would take place either during mitosis and meiosis. Robertsonian, we'll talk about their role, or non-disjunction are the three main ways. So if you just get a deletion event of a... we'll talk about non-disjunction first. Okay. So non-disjunction just means when you're separating cells or separating chromosomes that you don't do it evenly. Remember, we talked about that there's timing involved and you need to move the chromosomes to opposite ends of a cell. In this case, that we're doing meiosis. And in that they need to be pulled apart before the cytokinesis takes place and separates the cell into two. So in this case, normally in meiosis one, what would happen, these two homologs would be divided, and so we would have one in each. Okay. But if non-disjunction occurs during meiosis one, okay, the homologs aren't separated, so we get a cell that's missing this chromosome. So we'll say if this is chromosome 1, you get a cell that doesn't have a copy of chromosome 1 and one that should, or one that will have two copies. At this point in time, both cells should have a single copy of chromosome 1. So we've got one with too many, one without. Then we go through meiosis 2, and in meiosis 2, we're just separating the sister chromatids. So we separate these sister chromatids. Okay. And so we've got two copies of chromosome 1 in this cell, two copies of chromosome 1 in this, no copies of chromosome 1, no copies of chromosome 1. During fertilization then, if these gametes fertilize with a normal gamete, these will produce trisomic, tri meaning three. Whenever you see somi, that means we're talking about the number of chromosomes. So these are trisomic, that they have an extra copy of chromosome 1, since each one of these gametes carried two. And again, typically, if that's going to happen, it will be the egg that went through non-disjunction, because a sperm carrying around an extra chromosome is going to be much slower moving than a sperm with a normal genetic content. And then if these fertilize, then you would have monosomic. So they only have a single copy of that chromosome, and we want them to have two copies. And so in the case of non-disjunction in meiosis 1, none of the offspring from fertilization with a normal gamete will produce offspring with the correct genetic content. half will be trisomic, half will be monosomic. But if non-disjunction takes place in meiosis II, okay, so the separation of the homologs takes place wonderfully during meiosis I. We've got each one of these cells has a single copy of chromosome 1, but now up here, non-disjunction takes place in this cell lineage in meiosis 2. We don't get the sister chromatids pulled apart before cell division takes place. So this copy gets 2. This copy, or this cell, has 0. But it's very unlikely that non-disjunction happens in both of these lineages. So this one goes through normal separation, one chromosome each in these cell lines. Then if we look at fertilization, if non-disjunction occurs during meiosis II, half of the offspring will have the normal genetic content. 25% will be trisomic and 25% will be monosomic. So there's a huge difference in terms of survival rate of the offspring as to whether non-disjunction occurs in meiosis I or meiosis II. Meiosis I is a much more severe event with typically no viable offspring. In meiosis II, half the offspring will typically be viable. We'll go ahead and develop normally. And then this is just showing that if they proliferate, that after you go through the fertilization event, that's what the organism is made of. And so just all the cells either being monosomatic or monosomic or trisomic doesn't work out. Okay. So here are the terminology for some of these. Nullosomy. So you lose both copies of a chromosome. Null just means empty or nothing there. So nullosomy, you would be 2N minus 2. So 2N denotes the diploid condition. So that would be you've got two copies of every chromosome, but you're missing two chromosomes. And in nullosomy, they would be the same chromosome. So we would typically, in human genetics, we would say 2N minus 2, and then there'd be a subset down here like 214 if chromosome 14 was lost. Okay. Nullosomies are not viable in humans. So you can look at tissue and see that a developing fetus was 2N minus 2, in this case 14, but you're not going to walk up to somebody on the street that has this condition. This is lethal in utero. The vast majority of these are lethal in utero, so before the child is even born. Okay. Monosomy is 2N minus 1. Okay. You're missing a single chromosome. The only time in which this is viable in humans is Turner syndrome. Remember Turner, they're XO. There's so little information on the Y chromosome, you can lose the Y chromosome and be viable, or you can lose the X one copy of the X chromosome. Because remember, the X chromosome, if you've got two of them, one of them is inactivated. And so the only monosomy in humans that isn't a lethal condition is Turner syndrome. And so it's 2N minus 1, and then it's usually subset XY, because unless you go in and figure out which parent donated the X chromosome that's there, you don't know whether they lost an X or a Y. Okay. Trisomy is the gain of a single chromosome, and it's denoted 2N plus 1. You've got an extra chromosome. In humans, the most common one is trisomy 21, which is the technical term for Down syndrome. There's also 14 is slightly less common. We'll talk about some of the trisomies that aren't lethal in humans, but there aren't many. But you can get the sex chromosomes. You can be trisomic for X. But 17 or 14, 21, some cases 22. And then tetrasomy, it's 2N plus 2. The only time that you see that in humans is with the X or Y chromosome, being the extra chromosomes. Okay, but in other organisms, it's not as cut and dry, that these conditions still produce viable offspring, and so you get this genetic variation that takes place. Okay, so just a concept check. So if a diploid organism is 2N equals 36, how many chromosomes will be found in a trisomic member? 37. You're just carrying an extra chromosome. It's not the entire sets that are copied if we're talking about trisomic, that we use slightly different terminology for those that we'll talk about in a few minutes. Okay, I thought I had a picture. So Down syndrome is extra copies of chromosome 21. And so before we work with humans, I guess we'll look at seed cases in plants. That plants, there's much more variation in the number of chromosomes and even the number of sets of chromosomes. This isn't a plant genetics class. There probably should be a plant genetics class in the school because the way that plants do things are significantly different in terms of their flexibility. But all of these outcomes of the seed cases vary from the wild type as a result of different trisomies in this line of plants. So in plants, the system is much more forgiving for variation in with respect to the number of chromosomes. Okay, so here's the most common examples of the sex chromosome aneuploidies in human. Turner, again, is the only monosomy that's viable in humans. Klinefelter is a trisomy, as is triple X syndrome, where you get females that have 3X. For autosomal, trisomy 21, again, Down syndrome. The vast majority of Down is caused by non-disjunction. And it's typically non-disjunction in the egg. Okay. Again, we mentioned why that is, because a non-disjunction in the sperm puts the sperm at a big disadvantage. So, sorry to dump this on you ladies, but we already talked about the effect of maternal age on the likelihood of some of these disorders. Down syndrome is one of them, that after a woman gets into her 30s, that the likelihood increases. But again, much of that is just due to maternal monitoring and editing of her ability to recognize if the genetics of the developing offspring is correct or not. But part of it is due to sending out eggs that have an extra chromosome in it. But about 75% of people with Down syndrome had it as a result of non-disjunction in the egg formation. But about a quarter of cases of Down syndrome are this familial Down that I mentioned a few minutes ago. That's a result of a Robertsonian translocation in which chromosome 14 and 21 become fused. And so here we have, this is a primary or the typical Down syndrome, the karyotype. And so we're really looking for, down here, chromosome 21. And we see three copies of chromosome 21, and we've got two copies of 14 up here. So this is just a primary non-disjunction event that took place, and an extra copy of 21. Okay, here's a case where we've got, this would be a Robertsonian translocation. 14 looks okay. 15 in this case. So, sorry, they used an unusual example in this case. There's been a Robertsonian translocation between chromosome 21 and 15. Okay. So remember with that basically the big part of one chromosome will fuse to the large part of the other chromosome. So the second copy of 21 is now up here attached to 15. Okay. This person would not exhibit Down syndrome. They've got two copies of 15. they've got two copies of 21. So this person, you could be sitting next to this person right now for all you know, that this person would have no visible phenotypes from the outside. But this person is essentially a carrier for Down syndrome. Okay, so when they undergo meiosis, that if this copy of chromosome 15, let's see if we got a diagram. Okay, we do. So the person with this karyotype, this is what happens when their cells go through meiosis and fertilization. That you get one copy of 21 here, one copy of 21 is attached to 14, except in the last karyotype it was 15. And here we've got the lone version of 14. So what happens if you get the dual chromosome? When that moves through, you're either going to get an extra copy of 21 or 14 in a cell. Okay? You can get normal meiosis where you get this 14, this 21, and those offspring will be fine, but it's when you get the translocated chromosome. If you get the translocated chromosome and 21 together, okay, so in that case, during meiosis, the 14s were treated as homologs. So they divided, but it didn't line up 14 or this combined chromosome and 21. It focused on getting 14 right. You can carry the longer chromosome and 21 together. That after fertilization, you'll get offspring that have three copies of chromosome 21, two normal-sized ones, and then the one that's being tagged along with chromosome 14. Okay. So you then also get lethal combinations in which they're monosomic. Okay. Or in this case, you get trisomy 14 is typically aborted. So what happens with Robertsonian translocation of familial down? Two-thirds of the live births will have normal phenotypes, okay, with half of them genetically being 2N. The other half are the carrier for this translocation, that they've got 2N, but they've got the translocation. Half of the normal appearing offspring don't even have the translocation. And then a third of the live births will have down. So these families realize that when they've got kids with down, when you know, even mom's young, dad's young, and they consistently have family members with Down syndrome, it's because it's inherited as a result of that Robertsonian translocation being carried through that family. Okay. Some other autosomal aneuploidies, trisomy 18 is fairly rare, but it does occur about 1 in every 8,000. Trisomy 13, you don't need to learn the names of these. I just want you to learn that there are some other trisomies. But for the most part, they're much less common than is trisomy 21 because they tend to have more severe outcomes during development. And then we talked about some of the causes. Maternal age plays a part. This is just Down syndrome, in case you've never hung out with somebody with Down syndrome, that there are many days in which I wish for this life because they tend to be really pretty easygoing, happy people for the most part. So unlike my colleagues, and newer studies have suggested that the amount of any effect on mental development of people with Down is less severe than originally thought. A lot of the perception that people with Down are often severely disadvantaged with respect to intelligence is because they never got the proper instruction. They typically were, you know, not allowed into full-blown school systems and classes. And we now understand that there are many cases of people with Down syndrome that are fully functional on the intelligence front, that they don't show any below average intelligence. Most of them do show some amount of dip in IQ, but that's much less severe than we thought 25 years ago. So, and then maternal age, this is the chart that I told you has since been challenged. But this is the one that just panics women. So guys, if you get to be 30, that's why about age of 35 or so, women start behaving dramatically different. So women, when you were 20, that would never look at you. If they're still single and you're still single at 35, you're in the game. There's an inverse curve that was shown Newsweek. Newsweek caught a lot of flack like last week or 2 weeks ago. They had a cover of Muslim Rage or something with just guys screaming. It was like a picture you see on FARC a lot of times. And so this one page showed some of the really bad Newsweek covers of all time. And one of them was from like 1986. And it showed the likelihood of a woman being married if she was single at a certain age. And it's inversely related to this. That it's kind of like, okay. And if a woman was single when she was 35, that it's like it dropped from about 70% down to about 15%. And that was what they went with on the cover of Newsweek. So that combination of events, of likelihood of getting married and the likelihood of women tend to be aware of the fact that having Down syndrome and other birth defects increases at that age. Okay, and then the other thing real briefly we'll talk about is polyploidy. Polyploidy is multiple copies of entire sets of chromosomes. Oop. You can't be polyploidy in humans. There's nobody out there that's 3N or 1N. Where you see it most often are plants. And you can get entire new strains of plants that arise through polyploidy events. So here's just an example on a slide talking about the mechanism and how it persists. But in humans, you can't be viable with an entire extra set. So anytime that you hear the phrase triploid or triploidy, that's referring to entire sets of chromosomes as opposed to trisomic. Somy meaning an individual chromosome, ploidy meaning entire sets of chromosome. Okay? All right, thanks for sticking through my gravelly voice this morning.